Tobias Carlyle is the founder and principal of Acquires Funds. For regulatory reasons, he will not discuss any of the Acquires Funds on this podcast. All opinions expressed by podcast participants are solely their own and do not reflect the opinions of Acquires Funds or affiliates. For more information, visit acquiresfunds.com.
At IKEA, your dream home is a blue bag away. No matter the size of your space or budget, we've got everything you need to turn your dreams into reality. And now with new lower prices on hundreds of our most popular products, bringing the dream home is even easier. Like the gray Strandom wing chair, was $369, now $299. And the IKEA Plus 365 9-piece cookware set was $129.99, now $89.99. And hundreds more. Shop new lower prices at ikea-usa.com today.
Hey, it's Tobias here. If you want to learn a little bit about my firm or see my portfolio, head on over to acquirersfunds.com.
So, save that one.
And we're live. We're streaming.
Yeah.
We are over the top. Over.
What's up, everybody?
The top.
I am.
What time
back
is it everywhere?
After a week of vacation, it is 10:34 a.m. on the West Coast. Means it's 1:34 p.m. on the East Coast. It's like 4:30, 3:30 a.m. in Australia, 5:30 UTC, something like that. I don't know. How's everybody doing? What's happening?
It's actually 5:34 in 3:34 places. It's not a 56-minute
change. How does time work? Nobody knows.
No one does know. It's all a construct.
Good energy
I don't know.
Today. I think the break has got everyone pumped up, huh?
That's right. I got
it. Yeah, I had a good break. I took the kids, went on the lake, went to Sonoma, went to San Fran. I am revived.
Look at you.
I'm back.
You sound good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've noticed with you, I've noticed that if I send you a Twitter message, I now have to wait maybe 7 to 10 days to get a response. So that may have something to do with your clarity of mind also.
Yeah. I'm not spending a lot of time on Twitter at the moment.
No, it doesn't appear so.
That's yeah, I spent last week off and I had a look at the messages. The messages was an absolute disaster this time around. So apologies to everybody who sent me one of those messages.
Can you just burn it down and start over?
Yeah.
Dude, looking for like old messages on that thing is just
terrible. Even for someone who you speak to regularly, it's not good. You got to hunt for those messages. It's hard.
How hard
it's
would it be to add worse. Search in the messages? It's like
it's Twitter, sir.
You got to pay for that.
Jesus.
I don't even know if they're going to do that.
Is this crack team working on? If not, just add search to the DMs.
I don't know. Not going to lie. The development of products has been a little slower than I'd like. Spaces, I think, is big.
It's a good platform.
I went on Greenhouse.
As long as you stay off it.
Yeah, that's right. As long as you don't get addicted. I went on Greenhouse, Spotify's thing. That sucks. And Clubhouse seems to have some issues. So the audio thing, I think Twitter and Facebook probably end up winning, but they should be doing more. Anyway,
What topics have we got today, fellas? We haven't talked about this beforehand.
No.
Let me get out in front of it and say I got Berkshire's earnings. So what do you guys got?
Wow, there you have it. I might talk Curate. I'll talk Curate. Fuck it. Everybody loves that.
All right. I've got, it's back to school. So I've got a multidisciplinary piece put together on the game theory of greetings. That's going to cover a bunch of different.
The game theory of greetings.
Yeah. We're going to get, we're going to get animals in there. We're going to get game theory. It's going to cover
a lot
of bases.
Let's kick it off with Berkshire because I want people to hang around. Game theory of greetings. Is that like when you throw the baseball bat up in the air and you grab it and whoever grabs closest to the top has the conch or whoever that works? I'm not entirely sure.
I don't think that's what he's going to talk about, Toby. Maybe.
Let's do Berkshire's earnings because Buffett, people love Warren. So the big takeaway, I think, is that they're still net sellers. They've been punching out bought $2.1 billion worth of, sold $2.1 billion of stock, bought $1.1. They've sold out of a whole lot of stuff.
I think this is fake news, dude. They bought their own shares.
Well, I'm not talking about the shares. I'm talking about their holdings.
Okay.
So that's on like 900-ish billion of assets total. So don't get too
just trimming around the edges, but selling rather than buying. Like that's just directionally, it's interesting.
Yeah.
Spent $6 billion on share repurchases, down from 6.6 in the first quarter. Down from $9 billion in the two quarters before that. But still, obviously, still thinks it's cheap because buying back has said in the past that they wouldn't sell below $20 billion in cash. Has raised that to $30 billion. But he's got 70 or 80 that he would love to put to work. Broad-based recovery. Just about everything is up, including the railroad. The railroad revs, and I don't know if this is because last year was a bad comp, but the railroad revenue was up 26%, pre-tax earnings up 33%. That's extraordinary. It's like some sort of SaaS tech stock, the way that's running.
Yeah, I think that's a low base. What is it off 2019?
I don't know. I didn't dig into it that much. Revenues... and the real estate brokerage is plus 48%, pre-tax earnings plus 129%. That's not bad.
To give you a sense, UMP is up quarter two, 29% comp to 2020 quarter two. So
consumer products, manufacturing, revs plus 68%, pre-tax earnings plus 197%. That's Forest River RVs, Duracell, Brooks Sports, Fruit of the Loom. Building products plus 29% in revs, pre-tax earnings plus 40%. That's Clayton Homes, Shaw, Johns Manville, Acme Building Products, Benjamin Moore. That's the paints, MyTech Construction and Engineering. Blockbuster return, not bad for Berkshire and Buffett again. Anybody surprised by any of that?
Well, I think some of that's a bounce off of a low.
It's a bounce, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'd call it blockbuster. I think it was just very solid. Very Berkshire-like, just kind of relentless forward progress, one foot in front of the other. Obviously encouraging, kind of more from a general U.S. economy state, because it is a nice keyhole into the U.S. economy. But yeah, I think it's good. I think they're just executing relentlessly.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, Progressive's kicking their ass in car insurance. They're going to have to, there might be a problem there.
Why do you say that?
And they just are. Like, if you look at the results from Progressive, there's something going on there. I don't know how big of a deal it is, but
it's flow.
Yeah, better advertising. The Geico Gecko is just a little bit old hat, and Flo's the new hotness. I mean, like 10 years of new hotness.
I mean, I don't think it's that. I think it could be years of so Progressive sort of like. They invested a lot in, I'm pretty sure it's telematics is what they did. And I mean, like their loss ratios are much, much better. I don't know. I wouldn't be shocked if Geico's got a little bit of a legacy. We competed on cost and they underinvested in the business a bit. That would not shock me.
Do you think it's telling that he's a net seller? Like obviously, we're talking minimal around the edges, but he hasn't bagged an elephant in the last quarter. Obviously, we would have heard about that beforehand. But net seller of equities, net buyer of Berkshire Hathaway, does that sort of tell you, Berkshire Hathaway stock net repurchaser, does that sort of tell you about the state of value more broadly? Like Berkshire Hathaway is a representative of value, very cheap, underlying doing very well, but can't find anywhere to deploy.
Motivated reasoning here, huh, Toby?
Yeah.
Is that a leading question?
Yeah.
Objection,
yeah.
Leading.
Yeah, leading the witness.
I don't know what they sold. I'm not reading too much into it. I do think something that's interesting is their bond book has like skewed more and more foreign, less and less corporate, which kind of makes sense to me. Corporate as a percentage of the overall bonds really took a dip down this past quarter, but their foreign bond holdings are substantial relative to the rest, which I thought is kind of interesting.
What do they own? Foreign sovereigns or foreign corporates? Yeah.
Sovereigns for the most part, as I understand it. It's probably some asset liability matching, but then I looked at their debt stack and it's predominantly US. But then again, you got U.S. cash flows. So I don't know how he's thinking about it, but I just find it interesting.
Well, they certainly borrowed cheap foreign currencies or money as well. So I don't know. It is probably some matching.
They've got some zeros in it, like zero coupon bonds, right, that they've been able to issue over time.
Yeah, in Japan. Yeah. Wow. I don't know. I think it's like a pretty good result. But I am concerned a little bit about what's going on at Geico. I think that warrants attention if you own the stock.
Is it the Dairy Queenization of Geico?
I mean, I don't know. Somebody like Bloomstrand probably has a much better idea than I do, but it just seems to me that Progressive is writing a lot more and losing a lot less, and that's a pretty decent combination.
Maybe they got to steal away Flow the way Sprint stole away the, was it Verizon? The Verizon guy?
Oh, yeah.
Did they?
Can you hear me now, dude?
Yeah, that guy. You remember that?
Huh.
What's up with using the same, like, what are the same guys appearing in all these different ads? Is this like a handful of actors who are able to do an ad?
Probably.
I guess. I always thought it was pretty smart to make it the Gecko, because then, like, if it sounds like Flow, Geico. Well, no, not just that, but it's the same thing with like a lot of the cartoon royalties where the actor can get big enough to where they then want to demand more of the economic share of the value creation. Whereas the Gecko's agent, he's not working very hard because he doesn't exist.
I've noticed that they've diversified the flows. There's quite a few other stars, you know, in those ads now.
Yeah. Jamie and whoever.
Just keep her on her toes. Tell her let her know she's expendable.
Yeah, that's right. You don't want her comfortable. Don't start negotiating for real money, Flow.
If you go to different business. If you go to different countries, there are different flows. There's an Australian flow.
Huh.
Really?
That makes sense.
Yeah.
I wonder if she gets paid.
Fracturing the marketplace for Flow.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's a good point. Someone said the most interesting man in the world. He got moved out. There's a new most interesting man in the world. They went younger.
It'll happen. Happens to everybody.
All right. I think we've flogged this horse to death and beyond. So,
You know, the other thing that I think is kind of interesting about Berkshire when you look at it is how good of a lending business Clayton Homes is.
Mm, yeah. Hardly it's any
like
write-offs.
If people want to like look at interesting stuff, they get to charge a lot and they don't take a lot of charge off. So, it's a pretty good lending business.
Why don't we have more manufactured homes in the US? It seems like we should be working towards some Jetson style, like Lego building home. Instead, we're like doing what we did 50 Customs. Years ago.
NIMBYism, man.
Yeah. People care? Why would you care if it's like put together, what do they call it? Modular, like in a modular way. And then
Wow.
Look pretty good too. They're not like eyesores or anything. It's not a trailer park.
Yeah, I've seen more. I saw one the other day driving down. It was two trailers and they had halves of a house and they were going to, I assume, just put it together.
And you don't have to put it together you don't have to put two halves of the house together. Can't you just put together like the walls and like just bolt the walls together? I don't know how any of this stuff is done. I'm way out of
I'm telling you, that's what they were going to do. They were going to put the two halves together.
Oh.
No, I think, I don't know why. You would think that there's got to be something. Like logic would maybe dictate that there should be some way to build homes that are less expensive, but our economy does not do it for some reason. And I do think, like, as far as manufactured housing, it's got a real stigma in the US.
Where I live, I think if you knock the house down, the land is worth a little bit more for the most part.
Yeah.
A lot of old homes on expensive land.
It's kind of like where I am. Problem down here is you can't improve them because it's all in a flood zone, right? So like you can't, FEMA won't let you put over 50% of the value of your house into your house, but like the structure is worth so little that if you like redo a kitchen, you usually like hit your 50% allotment. So you have to like do that and then you've got to rezone it and then you've got to go in for more approvals. They're really trying to incentivize people just bulldozing houses to build new ones. Because if you do that, then you have to build your house higher on the land. So
I thought it was some broken window Keynesian GDP expansion.
No, I think it's a goal to minimize flood losses over time. Maybe privatize more of it. I don't know.
Hit us with some veggies, JT.
All right, let's get into it. So this is titled The Game Theory of Greetings. And some of the stuff we're going to cover is out of this book called Wild Rituals by Dr. Caitlin O'Connell. And she's like spent a ton of time in the African savanna studying elephants. But animals all have greeting rituals, social animals. And some of them are kind of funny. I know you guys like the all the animal things. I don't know why you come to investing podcasts to learn about animals, but whatever. So one of them is
what do the sperm whales do, JT?
I know that's what everybody wants, the sperm whales, but I don't have any sperm whale greetings. But hyenas will apparently present their erect genitalia to each other during a greeting ceremony, which is obviously a way of making themselves vulnerable. And we'll get into a little bit more of like why they would want to do
that.
That's
how Toby and I met.
Exactly. Now, elephants will
greet. No way to do that anymore.
Yeah, well, we got vulnerable together and then we got over it. So now it's just flaccid introductions.
Yeah. So elephants will greet each other by placing their trunks in each other's mouths, which is kind of an interesting thing. But and then if it's a very joyous reunion, they will both simultaneously evacuate their bowels and their bladder in unison. So elephants do things a little bit different, but there's actually a biological reason why they will greet each other this way. And it allows them to smell what the other elephant was eating. And then presumably what they've been eating is then safe, given that the elephant that's, you know, they're meeting hasn't died. So it's a way actually for them to gather information about their environment. And that's the same reason actually like dogs will lick each other's faces and try to lick your face, is to figure out like what you've been eating so that you don't, you know, so that they don't, they know that it's more likely to eat, that it's safe to eat whatever that other entity's been eating. So humans have a lot of different greeting rituals, you know, and they're always about being a signal of recognition, of goodwill, of welcome. And, you know, that Inuits, Eskimos have like, you know, the Eskimo kiss where they rub noses together, a lot of bowing, a lot of handshakes, which that actually came from checking to see if the other person had a weapon on them, like a dagger buried up their sleeve. And actually the shaking motion might have been to like see if anything
shook
loose, right? Like, I'm going to shake your arm to make sure that like whatever you have in there will fall out. And that way I know you're not trying to kill me. And then you have, you know, things like the kissing the ring of the mafia don. All these things are about, part of it is about hierarchical sorting, which can reduce tension, like when someone's not sure who's in charge, right? It strengthens the bonds. And the other thing too is that it actually provides real-time psychological feedback. So you can see what the state of the other person is, as well as actual like exchange of hormonal feedback. So the pheromones that we put off, we smell each other and we like are gathering information about that person. And in fact, you know, we're often attracted to strangers because it reduces the chances of potential inbreeding and, you know, creates more genetic diversity. So they've done studies where they'll have people, they'll have women smell shirts that a guy slept in, and they will be attracted to the scent the further they are like genetically away from that person. It's kind of interesting. So all of this ties back into going like back to school for, you know, a lot of us have kids and everybody's going back to school now. And I thought that this would, I'm going to try to land this back into something good. Maybe you can tell your kids when they're going back to school. But there's a game theory when people are meeting each other where, and really like it's a, and shout out to my friend Paul in Ireland, who first kind of connected these dots for me on that. There's actually sort of like a Nash equilibrium that's taking place. If you know about prisoners' dilemmas, this is John Nash from the movie Beautiful Mind. That was about him. But this is the math that he was working on. This Nash equilibrium, which is defined as a stable state of a system that involves several interacting participants in which no participant can gain by a change of strategy as long as other participants remain unchanged. So this is classic prisoner's dilemma, where it doesn't behoove you to, you'd be better off if you defected But and the other person also has to defect as well. So it's sort of a question of like, who's going to go first, right? So in we have a, all right, I know someone who has this, he told his daughter this in particular. And actually, I've tried to make this sort of like a Taylor family motto, because I think it's such a smart thing. But it's, he tells them to go positive and go first. And really, you know, if you think about this prisoner's dilemma, the world is really programmed for like this sort of tit for tat, which is a famous strategy in game theory that is actually evolutionarily stable strategy. So it's very robust, actually, to, and it shows up in human form, which is like eye for an eye or the golden rule, right? Like it's always return what the other person is giving you. That's tit for tat. And so if the world is sort of programmed for tit for tat, the logical approach is actually to go positive and go first, because you're likely to get back what you put out there. So it's a logical opening gambit in a world that's programmed for tit for tat. So tell your kids as they go back to school, go positive, smile, say hi, go first, because the other person is kind of wants you to do it and they want to smile, but they don't want to be the one to put themselves out there because of this kind of prisoner's dilemma, right? Like who's going to go first? Who's going to be vulnerable? Who's going to put their trunk into the mouth like the elephant first?
Don't do that. Keep your trunk to yourself.
Yeah. Well, okay. Don't go too far with that, but, and this is especially true in situations, and this is where prisoner's dilemma, especially if there are multiple rounds of a prisoner's dilemma, you see cooperation start to emerge. When it's just a single interaction, then the actual like better strategy is to like defect and it doesn't matter. But if you're going to be interacting with the person multiple times, you want to get on that forward momentum, good basis of, you know, both defecting, both smiling, both saying hi, which is what school is. It's a multiple interaction prisoner's dilemma. So go positive and go first and get that going. And then really like it's, I like to think that it sort of increases your life's serendipity coefficient. You know, the more people that you meet and say hi to, and who knows where it ends up leading, right? You, Bill and Toby meeting each other because somebody was willing to go first and say hi, and you know, it leads to all kinds of crazy stuff. So tell your kids when they're, as they're going back to school, to go positive and go first, and teach them some game theory while you're doing it, if you can.
But that's great advice, JT.
Yeah.
You were there, I sir, as well.
I was there. Yeah.
Yes. You just kept your trunk in your own mouth.
That's what as I like to do.
Well, I agree with that. I think being positive and being being kind and going first is good. It has never served me wrong. I think some of the financial industry could probably do a little more rooting for each other and a little less rooting against each other. Saw some people taking some L's today. That's okay. You know, keep the process, make it back.
What blew up today? Something.
Catapult wasn't good.
What is it?
What is it, or how far down was it?
It was like 50% down, something like that.
Yeah.
What is that?
It's subprime lending. My understanding is that it's like lease to own type stuff, partners with retailers. It's not good when your velocity of sales slows down and you're running at losses and your loan loss reserves double. It's kind of the first quarter after you were SPAC and you pull guidance. There's some things that make people a little bit, but here's the thing about the guidance pull that I don't understand. Like after you increase your bad debt expense to the extent that they did, who the hell cares what you guide to? Like in my mind, you sort of lost some credibility there. So what do I care what you have to say? Now it's just figure out how to put Humpty Dumpty back together again, I think. But you know, I am an investor in OpFi, and there was a short report about it. So, you know, maybe the egg is coming to my face soon too. So we shall see. It's right here. The egg can hit me right in it.
JT, got a good suggestion here from somebody. The joys of sweat, the strange science of perspiration.
All right.
That's I wonder if they've got some sperm whale stuff in there. That's probably right up your alley.
I'm guessing sperm whales don't sweat a lot, given that. But who knows? Maybe they do.
I have no idea, but that's a good question. It's probably
they are under
book.
The water. I don't know that that's precludes sweating, but it seems like it would be difficult.
Sweat a lot when you swim. Humans
after
sweat a lot when
swim.
They swim.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's correct. They're just in the water.
Just don't notice.
That's right.
But I like that as a philosophy. I like that idea of positive and first and kind. Oh, that's great. The world would be better if everybody did that in the first instance. It's just hard when you're shy. Everybody's shy. But it's a good way to be. I endorse it.
Are you shy? You think you're shy?
Everybody is, dude. Everybody's an introvert. Are you joking?
I don't think I'm very shy.
I think it's context specific.
Yeah. Yeah, I buy that. I definitely buy that. Something that you guys said to me that I think is true. It's fun to be on a podcast when people sort of like want to come up and say hello. It's nice to not have to break ice when you're in a room.
Yeah.
That's very helpful. That's nice.
That must have been Toby that said that.
Could have been. Yeah.
It's kind of a big deal. I don't know if you...
Do people know you?
All right. What's your topic today, Billy?
Well, so I'm going to talk curate, but it doesn't have to be curate. I just think it's a really interesting situation right now. You know, so like, obviously I own the shares and some have asked me, will I be able to pivot if sort of the business hicks up or hiccups? And I'm not like, my history with this business is I've always been fascinated by the consumer psychology of it. Always. The valuation never fully made sense to me. And then it never made sense to me because it got too cheap last year. And here I like my free cash flow number is lower than a lot of people that I see cite, what their free cash flow number is. I think, you know, there's dividends that they have to pay out to a minority shareholder.
Is this prospective free cash flow or?
Well, who the hell knows? Right.
Okay. Well, I'm saying the numbers that you're, these are what you have yeah. sort of in your head of what you think they might be able to do.
Yeah, the business is in a really weird spot. Like, it doesn't really grow, but it also doesn't really shrink. But no one, I don't think anybody really trusts it because everybody's association, my own included, is that, you know, it's a legacy distribution business. And if you wanted to be a bull, I think you could argue, well, look at what 2020 was. It was the best year that that business has seen in a long time. And we're further along in the cord cutting narrative than we've ever been before. So presumably some of the shoppers have figured out another way to shop. On the other hand, like I would be lying if I said, yeah, I'm super confident in the asset's duration and perpetuity, right? Like there's clearly a legacy benefit that they get from the television. So like there's this really weird dynamic going on where I think, I mean, a large part of my bet was Greg Maffei, and he's got a really interesting decision to make right now because where the shares are trading, if they want to get aggressive with it, they could probably retire somewhere around 10% of the company if they wanted to do an opportunistic buyback. But if you go back and you read like historical transcripts, he was doing buybacks and the market didn't really react very well to it. So I don't know if he's a little bit gun shy to do a buyback. And I think if you look at some of the historical shareholder base, they're not exactly amped up about buybacks because they didn't work. And I think if you look at like a retailer like Bed Bath & Beyond, they did a lot of buybacks into an entity that it didn't work out. Right. So there's an argument to be made that maybe cash back is a better decision. And I just kind of think like I can argue on one hand that the business is stronger than it's ever been. I can argue on the other hand that margins have been declining and best customer spend has been declining over the past 3 years. So maybe it's not as strong as, you know, I think it is. And it's one of those, I think this is an interesting point in the company's history and capital allocation. We'll see how, you know, the books are always written when people are looking back at the story, right? But this is like a very, if you're interested in capital allocation and you're interested in Liberty, My buddy Francisco had a tweet, and it showed like the three different entities that Maffei was talking about and how his strategy and capital allocation is different in each, right? And like one is Liberty Broadband, and that is in large part Charter. So it's basically like a growth equity. So he's just going to keep buying in the shares. You've got Liberty Sirius, doesn't really have a lot of cash flow, so they got to wait. But one day will be a buyback story. And then Curate sort of has a lot more perceived uncertainty and probably uncertainty. So I just think if you're interested in capital allocation and you think he's moderately good at it, watching those three entities over the next 12 months could be a good learning process, you know, in real time.
They've done some interesting stuff there, right? Like carving out some of those cash flows for the prefs was kind of brilliant, creating like whatever that was, $1 billion in
Yeah, it was 1.25%. Yeah, so
from $100 million in flows out of $1 billion, right? Like that's pretty. And what was the equity on at that point? What was the multiple?
Well, pro forma
it was like 4 or 5, something like that, right?
Yeah, when they did it, so pro forma it was like 2.5. It was really cheap. It's not as cheap now.
Oh, he's so smart. Old Malone and Maffei. Jeez.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. So if people think that and they want to learn and they want to watch, like I think this is an interesting situation to watch, regardless of, you know, what the outcome is. Because I think it's hard to argue that the range of outcomes is insanely tight. Although it's one of those weird situations where you can retire so many shares that you could actually probably de-risk the equity quite a bit by retiring a bunch of shares. I used to think that I would want more preferreds in front of the common. Francisco got me thinking smarter about that. What are they going to do with debt rather than? Well, they're going to have $1 billion of cash on the balance sheet. They probably already do. So, you know, I think it's like 400 ish million shares out at what, $11. So call it a $4.5 billion market cap or whatever.
EV.
You could spend, well, the EV is a lot higher because you got all the debt. But you could take 450 million of the cash and take out 10% of the company and still leave yourself with 500 million of cash. It's interesting. They got a real decision here.
When you say that the market didn't like the buyback before, you mean the price didn't go up because of it? Is that?
Yeah. And I think that the market was probably right on that. I'm not sure that a levered buyback strategy was the right strategy to run at that time.
I mean, if you're a remaining shareholder, remaining partner in this business, and you think it's reasonably priced, why would you want the price to go up if buybacks are part of the kind of going forward strategy?
Well, I don't think that you do.
We're all on Twitter, sir.
No, I don't think...
Unless you have a very short-term mindset in which you just want to be punching out.
Yeah, well, I think that what I appreciate about the way that Maffei looks at the world is I think that there's a lot of people that would say, I'm right, the market's wrong, we're going to do this no matter what. And I think Maffei... historically has said to himself, like, the market actually is pretty smart and I should at least look at what the market's reaction is as some indication as to whether or not I need to sort of jigger my thinking. And I think that that's created some very smart outcomes for them. I tend to agree with you. I mean, I think if I was confident in the business right now, I would do a big buyback. But you know, I don't know what they're thinking, but it's one of those that, like, I think you could, if it stays here for 2 years and they take out 20% of their shares, or 3 years and they take out 30%, that's like one of those things that The Outsiders gets written about. But it's in the moment, it's kind of uncertain. So I just think it's a good learning experience for people to pay attention to. I'm certainly excited about it.
Do you guys know, that's Bill's talking about Curate, Q-R-T-E-A is the ticker.
It's all I ever talk about.
Do you guys have any view on Alibaba? Any of the Chinese sell-off?
I think
the Chinese
stocks are stupid cheap.
There's some interesting stuff that's popped up there, yeah.
Everyone that I have talked to that knows anything about China is like, you Westerners are idiots that don't read the documents that come out that the CCP actually releases. And if you actually read the documents, you'd actually see that there's logic behind some of this stuff.
What's the CCP's logic?
I don't read the documents. I'm an idiot Westerner, but I don't pretend to. That's why I said, like, I would have like a 3% position if I had, you know, Chinese exposure right now. I do think that, like, I think the VIE structure, people railing about that. Like, people say, what do you really own? You own a derivative. My argument on most common equity securities is you don't actually own shit. Like, no one is actually owning shares for the voting rights. If you're in a situation where you need to rely on your voting rights, you're like close to zero, right? We're not actually here owning 1,000 common shares because we can vote on it. Like, let's all be real about what we own. It's all just derivatives on other people's decision-making. So then I go, okay, well, so what's different about the VIE structure? And I guess you could say, well, China could just take all of that capital away from anybody at any given time. To which I would ask, like, why? There's, according to I believe I pronounce her name, Ray, like, she was, I talked to her last week. She's in, I think it's Tech Buzz China. The podcast is the one that she does. I mean, there's an insufficient amount of capital within China to fund the businesses that they're trying to grow. So, like, you're going to screw all the foreign investors now? Like, it just doesn't make sense to me. So I don't know. I think there's probably deals to be had in China. I don't know which ones they are. People smarter than me maybe do. But if I had to throw a dart, I'd probably pick Tencent. And then, I don't know. JD, well, probably makes sense too.
Baba, you got Manga in there. You got Lulu in there.
Yeah.
A better price than they got.
Yeah. I think if Westerners generally go risk off on something like China and they like wake up to this risk, I just think that's fear. Like, fundamentally, I don't actually think much changed, if there's some education crackdown.
There's a lot of hair in it, but at some point, like, the valuation starts getting interesting enough that, like, handicapping it with the hair on it, it's probably still worth taking a look at. Baba, Tencent, a handful of others in there.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know. I think there's hair on tech too. It's just nobody sees it right now because it's growing like crazy. So nobody gives a shit about these dual class shares, right? I mean, it's just what hair are you willing to accept and how comfortable are you? And for some reason, because we all, well, a lot of us, not all, but live on US soil, we think that Sam Fran is going to take care of us. Like, I think that's just as stupid as anything.
Yeah, so, ask Fanny and Freddie Common about property rights and in the US.
GM.
Sure.
Yeah,
for,
I mean,
profit colleges.
Yeah, like, look, I think my understanding of the education crackdown in China, and I'm going to get this wrong, but is that the education industry started really taking advantage of parents who wanted to give their kids a legitimate chance. And it got so expensive and there's such pressure over there that the government said, we're not okay with this, right? Because you're really taking away everybody's level playing field. Now, whether or not you want to be okay with that assumption, fine, right? But we're dealing with China. So that's the assumption they operate under.
Oh, I thought you were talking about the US. Sorry.
Yeah, I thought you were talking about US colleges too. I was like, yeah, well, we killed all the for-profit colleges and it completely solved that problem. Oh, no,
well, so this is like for kids, right? And they're like, they're running kids into the ground. They're studying, like, you know, tons of hours a day. So I don't know. I was able to listen to a couple conversations, and my only takeaway is that there are way more thoughtful people than most of the hot takes that I see that say that a lot of these regulations are actually pretty reasonable and arguably even more forward looking than what we're dealing with here, which is basically a Congress that can do nothing except for agree to spend.
Well, that's always been the case. That's nothing new.
So maybe you can argue good, you know, right? Regulations that don't work are better than regulations. That's a fine argument. So place your bet accordingly. But
I don't know. I guess the pitch for China is something like, you've got this political risk, but you got that everywhere anyway. You got this gigantic country that's growing very, very quickly. You can get some derivative exposure to that through these tech companies. that are like reasonably valued at the moment, or like cheapish if they're growing as fast as they are and everything remains the same. You can lose some money there too. So just size them, but you probably, there's probably some good exposure to be had there.
Yeah.
That's a reasonable take.
Oh, good. I'm glad we've resolved everything. We've got 15 minutes to go. Let's find something to argue about.
Let's get some questions in. If we
hit us with some questions.
We've been a little lacking on questions the last.
We have been.
Paul Higgins is in the house.
What's up, Paul? Boy from Ireland.
That's right. Who's got questions? Throw it up. I do agree. Somebody in the comments says, you know, like it appears that Lilu, you know, Munger's cloning him and Pabri's cloning him and Guy is cloning. I don't know
that's
that
how
I
value
agree.
Investing
turtles
works.
All the way down.
Yeah, well, and I'm also not sure that they're all cloning. They may all be on the same phone call. You know, it's just kind of working together, I think, is closer than cloning.
That's how FinTwit works. One person does the work and 50 accounts pretend like they did.
Is that the ratio? It's 50 to 1?
I don't know. It's probably more than that. Oof.
Danny Beltran wants to know the bull case on OppFi. I don't know. Go read their S1. Like, there's a lot of people that need their products. Banks can't give it to them. They have a better way of getting it to them, and they think that they're going to grow. Or they don't, and it all implodes. That's the bear case.
Right. You guys got any thoughts on video game companies?
Activision Blizzard's going through a major employee problem. Video games are pretty good businesses. They're very franchise driven. I haven't done the work to have informed opinions, but I would be a buyer on temporary weakness, all else equal.
Yeah, there's some cheap stuff in there. I think some of it looks interesting. But I don't have any deeper views than that.
Yeah, I mean, look, they're like very good businesses, right? I mean, it's gotten to the point where we're going to be on like Grand Theft Auto 57 at some point, and people are still going to be buying them. The franchises are very important.
They're going to get 7 out. How old? 6? It's like 7 or 8 years old.
Yeah, and like people still play it. Now you're going direct, and I'm sure they're going to have things that, well, you already have things that you can buy in game. You got community aspects. Like, I get it.
Yep. The margins on a game that is working are rather amazing, but you got to get it working.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's right. Roblox is interesting because you have user generated content. You know, you're not, that's a cool business. And you got the Robux. But again, I don't know enough.
So I'm having technical difficulties as always, but I'm on my second screen here.
I mean, somebody asked if Curie can go to other platforms. That's the entire debate. If they can, I'll tell you what, it's not a $4.5 billion company. It's going to be a whole lot higher.
Like going to your iPad or something? Is that the idea?
Well, YouTube.
Grandma's iPad, I mean.
YouTube, Instagram, like all that stuff. Just something that's not a channel. I think the harder question is like, what do the economics look like in that? Because you kind of have to like nudge somebody to come to that channel. And then are you paying? And then how frequent? Like Maffei had said a little while ago, when you're going over the top, it's like a more targeted purchasing experience, right? It's not as passive. Part of what makes that business great is how like passive it is. So we'll see.
Thanks for the Berkshire Guinness Kitty Fund contribution column for 20 euro. That's real money.
That is real money. Do you come out next time that we're there? You come have one of those beers with us.
Yeah, we might have to get you more than one.
Big spender.
We might have to fill you up.
I got mad love for him. Thank you.
He probably smash a few Guinness too.
That's right.
We might not be able to afford it. We might be riding a big liability there.
Jake, thoughts on SEC 15C2-11 about over-the-counter dark stocks? Is that what you're talking about?
I'm somewhat familiar with that.
Do you have thoughts on it?
Do I have public thoughts? Maybe. I think it's...
I think people are here for your public thoughts.
I know. It's certainly interesting to... So there's like 6,000 stocks. Let's back up a little bit and explain it. It's the SEC came out with some ruling a while ago, and it's going to be finally coming into effect. And the interpretation, I believe, by a fair number of the custodians is that they don't want to allow trading of these stocks that are on this SEC list. And they will then place these stocks into what they call liquidation mode, which means you can sell, but you can't buy. So one wonders, given that for every buy there is, or for every sell there is a buy, how you're going to match up the liquidation of this, like who's going to be able to buy it at that point? So if you are a short-term trader of stocks, then this list of 6,000, mostly like over-the-counter, and how you get on that list is you're not, if you're behind on filing with the SEC, your financials. Most of the companies on that 6,000 stock list are appear to be shells and pump and dump kind of scheme companies, not real operations probably. But there are some companies that might be legit. And so if you're, the opportunity may be there to, in a kind of liquidation scenario where people are selling for structural reasons and not necessarily for business reasons. And every company that's on there is one SEC filing away from getting off the list and therefore back as a normal security. So could be something there structurally to take advantage of. But thus far, my personal digging into that list has not uncovered too many babies that were potentially thrown out with the regulatory bathwater. But if you do have something on that list, I don't know, maybe we need a team effort on it. Team Value After Hours, if we can find something good on there, potentially.
Team Voss back.
How do you find the list, JT?
It shouldn't be too hard to find. I mean, all the custodians sent out a list to their customers. I know for sure Schwab and TD Ameritrade were on that list. But I imagine that there's a lot more. So I think it's pretty easy to find if you just search liquidation mode or something in SEC and in the recent, I don't know if it's been in the news or not, but it is a possible one of those, like, it's not hard to imagine 25-year-old Buffett taking that list and then running the Geiger counter over it to try to find something that was being thrown away.
Yeah. Somebody pointed out that Tandy Leather might be on that list. That might be true.
It was on the most recent list that I saw.
Anybody got any views on KKR?
Yeah, they looked at that. Probably do fine. I think all those alt managers are decent bets. Until the world explodes, I just don't see any stopping of the funds flowing to those guys. Whether or not, you know, the structure screws you somehow is something that everybody should analyze for themselves. But if you're talking secular tailwinds, I think those alternative asset managers make a lot of sense.
Why do you think there's an issue with the structure?
Well, I don't think there, I don't well, know that the there is issue? Or not, but you know, I mean, it's kind of like betting with Goldman, right? And then I would need to look at each one individually. I can't speak whether or not you own the GP or how much of the GP is owned by the partners, and how, where your LP interest really is. Like, I just don't know. But those would be the questions that I have.
I think I don't love some of the, from a long-term duration standpoint, the way that the deals get structured often in private equity are leave kind of a bad taste in my mouth. And what I mean by that is, like, we go buy this company, maybe we lever it up, maybe we do a little bit of things operationally to spruce up the income statement. Then maybe we sell it to another private equity company for a markup and we take 20% rake off of that. And then they do the same thing. They sell it. And then maybe we buy it back again. And so basically we just take this business that's supposed to be running and we move it around a bunch of times. And every time we move it, we mark it up and take our big 20% bite out of that. And it's just, I find it to be a little distasteful.
But as a shareholder.
Well, as a shareholder, potentially, but I wouldn't want to make that as a long-term bet.
No,
that
I'm with you.
Be a sustainable thing when you can't screw the customer over and over and over again and not have it eventually be a problem.
I got a podcast up. Slight.
Can you? You could.
slight diversion here, but I got a podcast up with Spencer Cole, who's the CIO of a thing called Vox Royalty. I wasn't really familiar with this stuff, but basically they go around and they find mining royalties. So often a prospector finds something and then they keep the royalty for themselves and they sell it off to someone who's either an operator or has the capital to develop the mine and turn it into an operating mine. And so it's sort of like a capital light mining type business. And they've done some interesting stuff where these guys, they came out of a mining company and they went and used optical character recognition to scan all these different documents from all these different jurisdictions around the world to identify these mining royalties that often people didn't know about. And this often happens if you're Australian or Canadian, you'd be more familiar with this, but you know, the listed companies, you know, they might be a gold miner this decade, and then for the next decade, they might be some sort of tech company, and they might go back into something, whatever else is hot in the market at that time. And after a series of these sort of transitions, there's no management in there, and nobody, like all of the institutional knowledge is gone, and they're not aware that they have this royalty. And so these guys have tracked these things down and brought this to the attention of two different mining listed companies that were in totally unrelated fields. And so they've kind of got this, I think, a unique database, and they've tracked all these things down and they're investing and collecting and rolling them up. But it's a really interesting model. Hmm. And the legendary story from the industry, or the sort of mining royalty type industry, is Franco-Nevada, where these guys found in a local newspaper in some small town an old mining prospector who was selling one for $2 million, a gold royalty. And that gold royalty has paid out to them $1 billion, and the NPV on what they think is left is another $1 billion. So it's a good little cash flow business. You're relying on their ability to identify these prospectively to the earnings coming in or to the royalties being delivered, but they've got a good database. They seem to know what they're doing. It's a really interesting podcast.
Hmm. I saw the video for it. I will listen to it. I like
it's a better way of, if you like mining and you think there's going to be some inflation, it's a better way of getting exposure, because they're you know, it's not as capital intensive as most mining companies are.
Our man Paul Higgins says that KKR, you're pretty aligned with the GPs, so that would be a positive. Some people are asking about Sam Adams TAP. I don't know. I think I like Dogfish. I like Sam Adams. They're fine. They're good brands, but man, seltzer's getting crowded. There's more seltzers than there are beers now, and that was hard.
Is it easier to make? Is that the...
I just don't think it's very hard to make. I mean, I think it's like yeah, well, I think what happened is like White Claw invented the category and they got like a huge first mover advantage. And then Truly was pretty good. AB InBev, my ex-beloved, really ruined their rollouts. For some reason, they thought Bud Light Seltzer was a good idea, which maybe that's why Carlos Brito got fired. And like they had Bon & Viv, that was garbage too. But there's just a ton. I mean, just go to the grocery store and take a look at the seltzer aisle.
Do you think that like business wine becomes a lot more kind of hit, a lot more boom bust? Like it used to be, beer companies were basically just a no brainer long through recessions and depressions and things like that, because nobody stops drinking when the world gets really bad. If anything, they increase the amount of booze that they drink, and so they're like safe as houses, those kind of beer companies. And now it seems like, you know, having a good brand, having a macro that everybody in the world recognizes, like that's sort of not as useful as it used to be. I don't think we've really tested it through.
I think in the rest of the world, that's maybe not true. I think in the US, that is true.
That macro is less good.
Yeah, because I think craft really attacked the big beer companies in the US in a way that was somewhat undefensible, even if they did become big craft beer brewing companies.
It's strange how the consumer preferences for different products change, where sometimes you want that same brand and you want a repeatable experience. You want certainty. And then other times you want novelty. You want uncertainty in what you're trying. You want to try a different, you know, flavors and brands. And I don't, it's not totally clear to me why Coca-Cola would be something that you want to have that same experience again, but, and Budweiser used to be that, but it's kind of maybe not anymore. I don't totally understand what the difference is, but it does seem, it is a weird kind of schism in human psychology.
I mean, I think some of it is that Coke is like a duopoly no matter where you go, right? And beer, you have just like, I mean, now it's up to thousands of choices. Like anywhere you are in the US has their own local brewery.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's because people are demanding it. So
it was a regulatory change, wasn't it? You were allowed to do it.
I don't know.
Previously, I don't think you were allowed to.
I think you could sell on premises, but I don't know that there's that much incentive to try to make your own cola.
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, beer you can charge a lot for, right? So there might be more margin. I don't know. Craft Sam, cola seems odd.
Sam and Pepsi are teaming up for alcoholic Mountain Dew. Who's in?
The labels look sweet.
Oh God, that's like that is the fast track to idiocracy.
they've managed to get the three sugar, caffeine, and alcohol together into a single. That might be the thing that tips us over the edge. It might be Mad Max Thunderdome from here on in.
Wash that down with a couple oxytocin and
Oxycontin.
Yeah, that too.
Sorry. Is that what I said? What I say?
Oxytocin.
Oh Jesus, no, Oxycontin.
Toby, the other thing is with beer, I think that it's starting to press up against like the wine price point. And I think weed is going to really hurt beer. I used to argue the other side of this, but I've morphed on my thoughts as I got more rational.
Does beer have a gluten problem? Is that why people are avoiding beer, or a wheat kind of thing?
I don't know. I just think you get fat on it. And people don't want to be fat.
Same reason that people are avoiding like pasta and bread. Like,
yeah,
you don't want to be a noodle shop at the moment.
Yeah.
Yeah. We need to get the weed into the Mountain Dew. Weed, Mountain Dew, alcohol. That's the four horsemen of the apocalypse. That's when you get Mad Max Thunderdome.
And that right now. We need to get on this.
I don't know that you put the alcohol in there too. I just
don't need the alcohol at that point.
Yeah.
No.
Let's get faded dew instead.
CBD, Mountain Dew.
Crazy. All right, guys. Well, we made it on that appetizing note. That's the week. We'll be back again next week. This is fun though.
It's good to be back. Missed you guys.
Indeed. Move with the rhythm. Shake it up. Stop when the clock hits 13. Sing 1, 2, 3, 4. Cause, cause, cause. No one can do it like we do it, like we do. Like we do it, 'cause no one can do it like we do it, like we do it, like we do it.